all of the macros were equated, and pretty much everything about the diet was as equal as they could make it. But then between meals, they allowed people like ad libitum snacks, I think was the design, and they found out that people on processed food diets tended to eat more, even though they reported the same amount of satiety, like subjectively. And even though, like, if you measure the satiety signals in their blood, they were, you know, kind of comparable, these people just could eat more if they were eating processed foods.
¿Qué tal, mi amigo? It's Ted Rice, health expert and host of the Legendary Life podcast. And yes, I'm aprendiendo español. And that's because I'm still here in Colombia, in Medellin, Colombia. Really excited to be here, eating some great food, meeting some great people. And today I'm super excited to share this episode with you because we're going to be diving into some important information with regards to nutrition. For example, have you ever wondered how much marketing goes on behind the scenes? Because today's guest, Nick Hebert, not only is he the creator of the nutrient density cheat sheet, but he is such a great nutrition researcher that a very popular individual asked him to co-write a book with him, and Nick turned him down because of questions about this guy's ethics. In other words, the dude wanted to make a lot of money and was okay kind of fudging the facts. We're going to get into that today. So you're going to hear that story, and some of you are going to know who that person is. So you want to stay tuned for that. Beyond that, we get into just a conversation about nutrition and what's important. And as I said, Nick created the nutrient density cheat sheet, which is a way to figure out how to get the most nutrition for your money. It sounds like a super cool thing. I really have never heard of anyone doing what Nick has done. So really excited to dive into that with you. Before we get to Nick's interview, I want to say this. If this is your first time listening to the Legendary Life podcast, what we do here is we clear up health and fitness confusion by breaking down science-based information on how to lose fat, prevent disease, and live a longer, healthier life. So if that's what you're interested in, you are in the right place. And if you've been listening for a while and you haven't left us a review yet on wherever you listen to this podcast, please take a couple minutes out of your time to make that happen. It's the highest compliment you can pay us. It helps more people find the show. And if you have any trouble leaving a review, if you try it, got frustrated, you can go to legendarylifepodcast.com/review. That's legendarylifepodcast.com/review. We put together some resources for you on how to leave a review so you don't get frustrated. You can give back to the podcast, and we've laid that all out for you. This episode is sponsored by Organifi. Do you want to know a secret that all my coaching clients follow? It's really simple, but powerful. Add vegetables into each meal. But let's be honest, most of us, including myself, don't eat the recommended servings of vegetables and fruits each day. So for those of us who are on the go or have trouble eating healthy, having a greens powder makes it easy to get your greens in every single day, no matter how busy you are. And that's why I use and recommend Organifi Green Juice, a superfood powder that you just add water to so that you can get your greens in even when you're on the go. The best thing about Organifi Green Juice is that it actually tastes great. But don't believe me, try it for yourself. And use the code TED20, that's capital T-E-D, the number 20, at www.organifi.com. That's Organifi.com to receive 20% off your first order. But hurry, this is a limited time discount for Legendary Life listeners. All right, enough talk. Let's get to the interview with Nick Hebert. Nick Hebert, thanks so much for coming on the show, man. Really excited to speak with you today.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, Nick, we were actually just having a conversation, and I was just like, you know what? Let's just click the record because this is too good. And some of the things that you're going to share with us right now are things that, I mean, I want to hear for the first time, and I want to share it. My reaction with the listeners, because some of it is just, Well, here's the situation. As I was telling you, Nick, the majority of the people who listen to the show, they're in their 40s, 50s, maybe even 60s. They're looking to lose fat, looking to get in better shape, looking to really live that legendary life. But there's so much information out there, and really it's misinformation, right? So much of it. And you have this, you and I, we met on Twitter. We agree about a lot of things about the really important stuff. And we both come from a place of wanting to help people cut through that. What would you say about the situation out there in terms of information?
I think it's extremely difficult for lay people to navigate the nutrition space in particular. Like the fitness space, the nutrition space, it's very difficult for lay people to actually navigate these spaces because they don't know how to separate the wheat from the chaff. They don't know how to separate good information from bad information. They have no way to assess information quality. So it's really easy for people to prey on that and give really, really bad advice, really, really bad information. And unfortunately, a lot of people fall victim to that and then wonder why they're not making any progress. And it's actually, you know, it's kind of sad.
Yeah, it's sad because what they end up doing is they blame themselves and they just have no way to really realize that, it isn't me. I'm just getting bad advice. Like carbs make you fat. Calories don't matter. Mm-hmm. There's something special about my genes or metabolism or maybe the toxins in the environment that's preventing me from losing fat. And then, you know, to bring up, to come back to what you said and to a story that I can't wait to hear from you is that I have a feeling that, and this is based on talking to a lot of people get really excited about certain individuals in this health and fitness space, and they don't realize a lot of it is just the popularity of that individual or individuals comes down to marketing. Mm-hmm. And you have this interesting story about this one dude in particular who some of the people listening to the show are going to know by name because he's been on a bunch of podcasts. He's does well on social media. He has a book out. And this individual wanted to write a book with you.
Yes.
What can you share? Can you tell that story?
Okay. So last year, an individual named James DiNicolantonio contacted me privately. And I guess since, you know, we've kind of had a falling out, and his approach to this was kind of nefarious. So I do not have any moral qualms with making this public. This guy approached me privately and pitched a book idea. And he wanted me to co-write the book because he liked the way I wrote on my blog. And the book was essentially going to be a rebuttal to fad diets, which is kind of ironic coming from him, and a rebuttal to the carnivore diet in particular. And the angle was going to be, what is the optimal human diet? And then he was going to use that as a rebuttal to a whole bunch of different diet fads. And he wanted to focus on the carnivore diet in particular. So a lot of the stuff that he talked with me about was like vitamin C and like manganese and potassium and, you know, typical nutrients that we would be concerned with on a carnivore diet. So he talked with me a lot about that. But the actual conversation that I had with him was very bizarre because he was saying things like, you know, we could get like $250,000 book deal and then we can just split it. And the information quality is kind of secondary as long as you can help people. It doesn't really matter if it's 100% accurate. It doesn't matter if it's open to amendment. Because one of the things that I told him was that I don't think I could ever write a book because I don't like to publish my thoughts in a format that isn't open to amendment and revision because I changed my mind like I changed my pants. So I would never really be comfortable putting my thoughts on paper in a book format. And he was like, oh, no, that's okay. Like, you're never going to get it 100% right. Like, it's okay if it's like if it plays fast and loose with the facts, as long as it can help people or as long as people think that they're being helped. And I could tell just by the way he was talking about it that there was a strong financial motive behind the entire project. I eventually turned him down because I didn't know who this guy was. And after that initial conversation with him, I was like, you know, okay, I'll think about it. And then I looked him up on Google, and the guy's on like Quackwatch. And I got myself familiar with a lot of his talking points. And honestly, I read some of the things that he's published to the literature as well. And I honestly was not terribly impressed. So I just said to him, you know what? I have other things to worry about. Thank you for the offer. And I turned him down just because I didn't really want my name associated with his name. It was, you know, more than I was willing to do. I don't think I could compromise my ethics in that way, because I really had a hard time getting behind a lot of the ideas that he was promulgating. And our falling out was basically around me criticizing the publications that he had published in the literature. One of the publications was about sugar being addictive, and the other publication was about vegetable oils causing heart disease. And I pointed out to him,
in particular, seed oils.
Right? Quote unquote seed
so
oils.
So crazy.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, like, just ignoring the fact that if you look at the epidemiology around sesame oil, like, holy crap, apparently sesame oil is like an exception to the rule with a seed oil that's like mostly PUFA. So it's like, oh, if you consume canola oil, you'll kill yourself. But if you consume vegetable oil, like, you'll be fine, because, like, in the epidemiology, at least, and even in some clinical trials, like, sesame oil, like, improves a whole bunch of biomarkers and parameters and whatnot. But anyway, so I criticized his publications for being non-systematic. They were narrative reviews of the literature, which basically means that you are free to cherry pick the literature at your leisure, and you don't have to apply systematic methods. You don't have to apply a particularly, like, strong degree of rigor. You can basically just cobble together a narrative or a story that suits whatever you want to get across. And I pointed this out to him, that his methods weren't terribly rigorous. And I pointed this out publicly, and he insta-blocked me, which was very weird, because we did have a very amicable, like, correspondence leading up to that point. And he was like, this is just...
You're bad for business, Nick.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bad for business.
Bye, Felicia.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. But yeah, his two publications, or at least the two that I'm familiar with, are the one related to sugar being addictive, and I wasn't very persuaded by it because it did not make a very compelling case for sugar being addictive. And the other one was about seed oils causing heart disease, which was equally as unpersuasive, because you'd have to ignore giant swaths of human outcome data in order to explain his model or his hypothesis. So I explained this to him, and he just didn't find it. He just didn't appreciate it. He insta-blocked me.
That's so funny. And for those of you who are listening, and maybe you don't know who he is, he's made the rounds. He's been on Rob Wolf's podcast. He's been on a bunch of other podcasts, much bigger podcasts than mine. He wanted to come on mine. I said no. I didn't want to talk to him, because, I mean, it's just his whole thing, at least his book, or maybe he's got another book out, I don't know, but the whole idea was that salt's not bad. Just eat salt, and actually you need salt, and et cetera, et cetera. Where there's actually quite a bit of literature showing that, you know, that can be a bad idea. Now, I'm not all read up on the connection between, you know, heart disease or high blood pressure and sodium. Perhaps, you know, you can go into that if that's something you've read a lot about, Nick. But
I have one or two comments, and nothing major. Like,
well, there was a big randomized controlled trial recently. Did you see where they took out the sodium chloride, so table salt, and then put in potassium chloride,
and then it improved a whole bunch of blood pressure related parameters. Yeah, and that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean,
the reason that getting too much salt is bad is because most people eat it in the context of not having enough potassium. So, like, the old DRI for potassium was 4.7 grams per day. Now it's 3.4, I believe. And the justification for 4.7 grams of potassium a day was that it abolished sodium-sensitive high blood pressure when it was tested. So, it's not that salt, quote-unquote, causes high blood pressure. Like, it certainly can it certainly can perturb the blood pressure if potassium intake is insufficient. And I think there are some people who just have a genetic predisposition to be hypersensitive to sodium, and those people probably should restrict sodium. So there's probably room for truth on either side here, but it's not so much that sodium is bad and sodium is going to raise your blood pressure. It's just having sodium so high disproportionate to potassium, it long-term leads to poor outcomes related to hypertension. Not that that's the only thing that modulates hypertension, but this where electrolytes are concerned and nutrition is concerned, that's basically the story that's laid out in the DRI report for potassium, is that it really is about just getting enough potassium. It's not that sodium's bad, it's just that people aren't getting enough potassium. That's why the DRI for potassium was so high. Like, for some people, especially if you're doing keto, it is super difficult to get 4.7 grams of potassium in a day. Like, sometimes I struggle with it, especially if I'm in a calorie deficit. Like, getting 4.7 grams of potassium is kind of ridiculous. Like, you either have to eat like a lot of leafy greens, or you crush a couple potatoes in a day, but don't eat any other carbs. Just like if you're in a deficit, like you kind of have to do some really weird things in order to get that much potassium in a day. It can be difficult.
Yeah, without supplementation.
Well, the thing is that supplementation is actually a problem, because by law, potassium supplements are regulated to be like only 99 or 100 milligrams, which is only like 1/34th of the DRI, of the AI for potassium. So like, it's because like some people have a reaction to diet to supplemented potassium where they get something called hyperkalemia and they can get a spontaneous they can have heart failure like on the spot by just taking a large dose of potassium all at once. So like,
yeah. And some people commit suicide by doing that. Unfortunately, it's right. It can be an issue, at really high doses.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, you know what I think, so that's an important point, right? Get your potassium handle. By the way, fruit is a great source of potassium. So are leafy greens, as you said, so are potatoes.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons why, you know, the low carb thing annoys me a bit with, and I used to be, we don't really know each other, Nick, but I used to be a very strict low carber. I had all the points down and, you know, okay, so look at diabetics. What are diabetics? Fat. What causes diabetes?
Sugar.
Sugar. So obvious, because what's diabetes? It's a certain blood sugar level, you know, or hemoglobin A1C level. So therefore, high blood sugar leads to diabetes, and diabetes makes you fat. So ergo, sugar makes you fat, right?
Yeah.
So easy.
No, I mean, yeah, they cobble together a pretty compelling story if they're talking to a layperson. If they tried to pull that stuff on me, I would quickly shut that down.
Well, yeah. And well, that was what I used to believe. And this was, I don't know, a little over a decade ago. So we have the benefit now of like, well, back then it was very different trying to get there's so much more research that's been published. The insulin carbohydrate hypothesis for obesity has been tested and found to be lacking in data, right? So anyway, but I used to say that stuff, and now I'm, you know, I saw the light. But a lot of people, it's so funny, a lot of the talking points that we used back then, over a decade ago, like people are using them now, and I just shake my head. I'm like, that's what we were saying like 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And it's so interesting that, and these are all new people to the low carb thing. Like they've been doing it maybe for 5 years, 10 years max, but 20 years ago, that's what we were saying because it seems so clear cut. And in my defense, some of the research that came out on low carb diets seemed to be extremely promising.
Yeah.
Now later we figured out that it came down to protein wasn't equated.
Yeah.
So just for those of you listening right now, when you jack up protein, and the fact that's what you and I were talking about a bit earlier, Nick, when you jack up protein and keep, if you increase the amount of food, amount of protein that you're eating, but lower the amount of either carbs or fat or both, you're going to get great results because of the powerful qualities of protein, right? On so many different levels. But now we know the details, and before then, but here we are, Nick, where all the information is laid out, but you got to be able to you got to be able to see clearly, right? You got to be able to see clearly. And there's a lot of people who are emotionally invested. Like I asked you about Ken Berry, who's an absolute nutcase.
Yeah.
But I asked you, I'm like, what do you think? Is he a true believer? And you said yes.
Oh yeah, no. He's hook, line, and sinker, man. Like the guy is absolutely insufferable.
Right. So I think that's important to know. Like, because there are people who are sincere, right? They just happen to be sincerely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you figure that out if you don't know what the evidence truly says?
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to say about that?
Oh, you know, that's absolutely true. I mean, like, it's really easy to just cobble together a story. And that's what these low carb people do. They cobble together a narrative. They cobble together a story with bits of like mechanistic information and confounded randomized controlled trials oftentimes. And they cobble together a really compelling story and they personally buy into it. I think a lot of them are very genuine in that they buy into it and they're honestly thinking that they're helping people. But the information itself is very poor quality and they're just taking advantage of the fact that people have a hard time identifying good quality information. And Ken Berry is a really good example of this. Ken Berry, the shit he says, man, it blows my mind.
Can you give an example? Because I don't follow him that closely on Twitter, but
I mean,
for some reason he keeps coming up in my feed. I don't follow him, but apparently some of the people that I'm connected with do.
Well, you know what? He's so reliable for this information that I could probably just go to his Twitter right now and find something crazy. A tweet from 13 hours ago, most nutrition research is not worth the paper it is printed on. Okay. Where's something else? Has the American Heart Association ever issued a formal apology for the health harm this has caused and pictures of the American Heart Association stamp of approval on cereal boxes? Like, the guy is just over the top.
Right. And let's talk a little bit about that, because some people might say, you know what, but cereal is processed food. That's not good. We should be eating vegetables. We should be eating like how our ancestors ate. We should be eating unprocessed foods. We should be eating whole foods. And for the most part, that is true, right?
I mean, it's definitely easier. It's good advice, but
it's good advice.
The problem is that those foods are not harmful through those foods aren't inherently harmful, and they're certainly not harmful in the way that low carb people like Ken Berry suggest that they're harmful. Like, they would say it's the refined grain, the sugar content. I mean, yeah, but it's not because the actual starch and like sucrose molecules are bad. That's not actually the reason why those foods are not conducive to health. The foods are not conducive to health because they are typically, for the average person, not very filling, and they do not promote satiety in the same way whole foods promote satiety. So people find it easier to overeat on diets that include processed foods. And that's really the explanation for it when you get right down to it. It's not really the sugar content that matters. It's not the fat content that matters either. Like, it's just the fact that these things are very palatable and they don't trigger your satiety signals the same way as whole foods. So those are primarily the pathways through which these things could potentially harm us. But Ken Berry would say that they're harming us because they're refined grains and they're sugar. And it's like, well, no, probably not. Because if you equated sugar and gave people whole foods, they probably wouldn't get fat because they'd be more satiated, not because the sugar.
Explain what you're talking about there, because equated. This episode is sponsored by Organifi. Do you want to know a secret that all my coaching clients follow? It's really simple, but powerful. Add vegetables into each meal. But let's be honest, most of us, including myself, don't eat the recommended servings of vegetables and fruits each day. So for those of us who are on the go or have trouble eating healthy, having a greens powder makes it easy to get your greens in every single day, no matter how busy you are. And that's why I use and recommend Organifi Green Juice, a superfood powder that you just add water to so that you can get your greens in even when you're on the go. The best thing about Organifi Green Juice is that it actually tastes great. But don't believe me, try it for yourself. And use the code TED20, that's capital T-E-D, the number 20, at www.organifi.com. That's Organifi.com to receive 20% off your first order. But hurry, this is a limited time discount for Legendary Life listeners. Now, back to the episode.
Kevin Hall did this really cool study where he like he had two groups, and I believe it was a crossover style design. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but basically he fed people whole food diets and then processed food diets, and they were ad libitum. So that means that there were no restrictions on the total quantity of food that they could eat, but all of the macros were equated, and pretty much everything about the diet was as equal as they could make it. But then between meals, they allowed people like ad libitum snacks, I think was the design. And they found out that people on processed food diets tended to eat more, even though they reported the same amount of satiety, like subjectively. And even though, like, if you measure the satiety signals in their blood, they were, you know, kind of comparable. These people just could eat more if they were eating processed foods. And I don't think it has anything to do with the sugar content. I don't think it has anything to do with the starch content, because those things were equated in the diet between the whole foods and the processed foods. I think it probably, like, my theory about this is that it has to do with the length of time, like the lag time to full digestion of the food. Like, it probably has something to do with the fact that whole foods retain their volume in the GI tract much longer than processed foods. And it's that volume inside of the stomach, inside of the duodenum, like it's the volume that determines whether or not you can cram more stuff in. And that volume diminishes faster with processed foods because they're so much easier to digest.
So let's open that up a little bit, because it's such a important point, and it's something that I teach in my coaching group, gastric distension, right? And because that's something you have to rely on. So let's unpack that a little bit. So what Nick is saying is this: what really makes you, let's really be simplistic about this shit, because it, in many ways it is. If you're hungry, you're going to eat.
Yeah.
And certain foods help managing your hunger, help get rid of hunger better than others. And foods that have high water content, foods that have a lot of fiber, so vegetables, fruits, whole foods, in other words, they take up more space, and that leads to a signal to your brain that says, hey, we got a lot of food in here, we're good. So this is a key thing, because a lot of the foods that are a bit higher or more dense in calories, they take up less space. That's, you know, they're more dense, right? Yeah. They take up less volume. I know you know, Nick, but...
Yeah, no.
I think I'm just kind of messing with... Anyway, I'm messing with the listeners too. So like, but yeah. And so you can eat, you can cram more of this stuff in, and it doesn't lead to like, oh yeah, I'm not hungry, right? Yeah. And so this is one of the keys. It's not sexy to talk about like the metabolic poison of sugar.
Yeah.
It's not as sexy to talk about as like, you know, carbs causing diabetes and causing your family members to get their toes cut off because of the neuropathy and the, you know, all the other stuff. It's like, no, you need to stretch your intestines, your stomach and your intestines a little bit by eating a higher volume of food. So you just have those satiety signals, so you're not hungry and don't eat more.
Yeah, it's like,
just hard sell, man.
It's basically a volume to calorie ratio. So like the more you can retain the food's volume in the GI tract per calorie, the more satiated you're going to be, the less likely it is that you're going to overeat. And, you know, it is, I personally think it probably is just food volume, because a lot of people will say that protein is uniquely satiating, but that's not always true. The whole reason...
Protein shakes, right?
Whey protein shakes. The whole reason bodybuilders rely on protein shakes in order to hit their protein target is because they're not satiating. They allow more opportunities to eat more protein throughout the day because they're not satiating, because they're very rapidly absorbed. So like, if you actually look at a satiety index that measures the actual satiety factor of each food or a set of foods, you find that protein really is all over the board. Like oatmeal gets a higher satiety score than a steak, and boiled potatoes get like the highest score possible on that list. So it's not really about protein. It's not about carbs, or it's not about fat. It's not about any of those things. It's just volume. Because if you think about what the foods are doing in the GI tract, Like the foods that break down the slowest are the ones that most promote satiety. The ones that break down the fastest are the ones least conducive to satiety.
Yeah, I think so. That's I hope that's clear enough for you listening right now. And it's something I teach in my coaching course and my coaching clients, so they start to understand this, because there's so many narratives about nutrition, about the toxins, about the carbs, and they just don't matter as much as something like this. Is one of the secrets, is what I'm telling you, is what Nick and I are talking about. And I think another important thing, Nick, I got into it with someone on Facebook. Actually, they were really cool, but I made a post because I was in this entrepreneur event the past few days. And during, get this, Nick, I mean, I think you commented on it, or maybe it was Tyler on Twitter, but I had pizza for lunch. And then there were two other fitness entrepreneurs there who specialized in body transformations, weight loss, et cetera. Yep. We all had pizza, bro, and enjoyed the hell out of it. And this guy who kept asking us, oh, so you do body transformation, what do you have to do? He had this salad. I don't think he was enjoying it. And it looked like the salad had more calories in it than the pizza. The pizza looked like a solid 1,000 calorie pizza or so, because the crust was quite thin and it wasn't loaded up with cheese. It was more of an Italian style pizza. And I'm here in Medellin, Colombia. So, you know, there's not that heavy American influence, you know, with the pizza anyway. So, and then you look at the salad, it's got like several ounces of some dressing that's probably loaded with oils. Not that there's anything wrong with oils, but eat too much fat will get you fat. So, and then all this avocado and all these seemingly healthy things, but it looked like it was maybe 1200 or 1300 calories. Mm-hmm. And these people are like, but I eat so healthy and you're eating pizza. And they were just like, it was funny. We're all laughing. And it's like, if you miss this, you miss everything. And then it led to a conversation on Facebook about like, well, pizza has some things where it could be healthy, but it's not really healthy. And then full sugar soda, I don't know where that came from. She just brought it up. But it's like something like full sugar soda, it's just empty calories. And I started saying, well, listen, I know there's nobody starving in the United States, okay? Right? In fact, are the people on the lower end of the socioeconomic strata have a higher likelihood of being obese. So our poor people are fat, in other words. Mm. But in other countries, poor people who are, you know, really poor by world standards, not US standards, they don't have enough to eat. So in a case where a child is going a day without food, having more calories can help them last a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. So maybe in that case, if you're starving, then any food is good food.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's very contextual here. Although there's not a bunch of vitamins and minerals in pure sugar, I don't think any, right? And even with honey, it's, you know, people say there's a lot of potassium. Oh, it's loaded with potassium. It's like, it doesn't really have that much potassium.
No, it's not especially, really. It's not really true. No.
No. No. So there's really this context here that people have like this what I call Western diet culture mentality, you know? Mm-hmm. And what do you have to say about that to help people maybe free themselves from like these perspectives that can help? Because we want to see the truth here. We want to approximate the truth, right? We're always going to be biased and we're human beings, but like what is closer to the truth? What do you have to say about calling foods bad and good and healthy and unhealthy? And
I think I'm not sure. It's probably pragmatic to box foods into good and bad categories for the average person. Like there is certainly utility just for the sake of making concise recommendations that are easy to understand. Like if you're trying to get somebody to lose weight and you know, you don't have to go into all the nuances with them, it's probably a good idea to just tell them that drinking soda is bad, right? Like for all practical purposes, there's utility in saying that to somebody who needs to lose weight, right? But like if you did want to go into the nitty gritty, it's like, is soda bad? No, probably not. It's not conducive to weight loss, really. And those calories are probably better spent in other places, but it in and of itself, is it bad? And I would have to say the answer is no. But on a pragmatic level, there probably is profound utility in just communicating publicly that, like, yeah, these things are bad, don't drink them. So it's you have to walk the line between the nuances and the sophistication and just the plain old pragmatism of it. So
I agree with you there. I would say this, though, the way I look at it, because I do a lot of coaching. And so when people start getting into the good food, bad food thing, you're absolutely right. Soda is not like, hey, let's do the soda diet, because really it comes back to what we were just talking about. It was satiety. It doesn't help, right? Yeah. It helps because of the water content, but beyond that, the sugar itself is not going to help with satiety. So it's easy to drink a lot of that stuff and then you need to eat because all you did was drink, right? And there's not much of that, you know, volume and gastric distension going on. But at the same time, when people start thinking, and I do agree with you, there's just a certain like, hey, soda's bad, stop drinking it. If you're drinking too much, really probably cutting down would be what I would personally say as a general rule instead of cutting it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I find that the more restrictive an approach is, it's like, well, if someone loves it, now I don't love soda, but I do love ice cream. If someone said, and ice cream isn't conducive to, you could make that argument that ice cream is definitely not conducive. It's even worse than soda because of all the fat that's in it. Cause I don't get the sugar. I mean, the fat-free stuff or, you know, frozen yogurt or whatever, but I'm not going to not eat, you know, ice cream. So just understanding those details, like understanding, okay, this isn't the best choice, but at the same time, I could squeeze it in if I'm willing to do the work, willing to do the food Tetris or the food, you know, budget myself, I can make this work. And there's nothing, like you said, inherently harmful about it.
Yeah. No, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's very context dependent. So like on a population level, let's say, there's tremendous utility in just saying that soda's bad, right? Because then it scares people away from it and perhaps you can curb some of the obesity epidemic by just making that blanket statement. But on an individual level, you can likely rationalize with each individual the caveats and the nuances and say like, no, soda's not like inherently bad, but you know, it's not conducive to weight loss and it's more conducive to weight gain. It's not very satiating. There's a whole bunch of reasons not to consume it, but it's not inherently harmful. Like you can rationalize with people on an individual level about like the quality of foods. But yeah, I would agree that I don't think there really is such a thing as like good or bad foods, like generally speaking. Of course, there are nuances, like somebody with a seafood allergy, shrimp is a bad food for them. But assuming you don't have any medical conditions like that, like, no, I don't think there is such a thing as a good or bad food.
Yeah, and for this, I should have also qualified. I mean, people who've been listening to the show for a while, they're beyond the, hey, stop drinking those 6 full sugar Cokes a day. Mm-hmm. They're beyond that. So I should have qualified that too. But good points here. And Nick, you know, I want to get into a little bit of what you've done with your nutrient density guide. Can you talk to us about it, what it is, why it's important, and how it's different than some of the other things there that are out there that go into like, okay, well, which foods am I going to get the most nutrition for the least amount of calories?
Yeah. So there are a whole bunch of different nutrient density scales out there. Like there's the Andy scale, there is the Nuval scale. There is, you know, there's a couple of them out there, and they all make these fundamental mistakes of injecting unnecessary bias into it. So they'll take, basically, this is the way the equation works for all of these nutrient density scales. They put the quote unquote good nutrients in the numerator and the quote unquote bad nutrients in the denominator. They divide one by the other and it spits out a score. Now, you can manipulate the outcomes of that to a huge degree just by mangling whatever nutrients you consider good and bad. So if you want to give a hit to animal foods, like if you want to dock points for animal foods, just put saturated fat in the denominator and then all of a sudden all the animal foods get a worse score. If you want to make plant foods look really good, you just maybe put bioflavonoids in the numerator, and then, oh, all the plant foods look really good. To me, that's not really a satisfactory way of doing it, because it assumes good and bad, right? Like what we were just talking about, it completely divorces itself from context and assumes that certain nutrients are good and bad. So what I did was I created a scale that's minimally biased, that basically this is how it works. There's 600 foods on the list so far. What I do is I take the nutrient yield of a food, and I define the nutrient yield as the nutrient content once you factor in bioavailability of each individual nutrient, absorption capacity, and metabolic conversion inefficiencies. And we can get into that if you want. But after you factor all those things in, you divide each nutrient by its respective DRI, the dietary reference intake set by the Institute of Medicine, which is how much of the nutrient you supposedly need in a day. And then you take all of the resulting scores for each nutrient per food, you sum them into a score, and you take the scores across all foods, and then you rank them and stratify them into a scale. So in my opinion, this is a minimally biased way of representing the nutrient density of a food as it relates to human nutrition, because the DRIs are where the human nutrition part comes in, and the nutrient yield is where the actual quantitative measurement comes in. And then you just, okay, related to human nutrition, how nutritious are these damn foods without any further bias injected in? Not even calories, because I think calories need to be considered separately. Calories should not be considered in the equation, because all it does is give you a silly little ratio, right? Like a poorly nutritious, low calorie food is going to get the same score as a highly nutritious, high calorie food, right? Like if you divide one by the other, all you get is a ratio. So it doesn't tell you a whole lot about the actual calorie yield of food. So I find that to be just, it's injecting too much bias, because it assumes that calories are pace. There's one score cheat sheet that actually gives points to added calories. The bodybuilding score gives points to added calories. So calories are not always bad, and putting them in the denominator across the board assumes that calories are always bad. So I created this nutrient density score, and this was originally a tool for me to just save money. And then I have the
nice.
Yeah. So I made this for myself like a year ago as a strategy to save money. So I quantified the nutrient density of each food, and then I had the price per 100 grams for each food. I divided one by the other, and then it just told me what to buy to maximize my nutrition for the least amount of money. That was basically what I designed it for. Now the sheet is absolutely gigantic, and there are millions of ways to personalize and customize your diet just by looking at it. So I have the total nutrition score, which is just the nutrient density score, and then I have it broken up. So I use the same methodology, but for only vitamins, and then I have another score that's only for minerals, one that's only for amino acids, and then I have another one that's kind of cool that's just vitamins and minerals. And the idea there is I wanted to consider foods that you're not going to be expecting to get a lot of protein from. So the way it's set up right now is the nutrients that are considered are essential vitamins, essential minerals, essential amino acids, and essential fatty acids. But not all foods are high protein. Not all nutritious foods are high protein. So I have a separate score that removes the essential amino acids, so that foods that are low in protein but highly nutritious aren't like forgotten on the bottom of the list, right? So like things like wheat germ and sweet potato and pineapple, those things are at the top of the list when you actually look at the vitamin and mineral content and ignore the amino acids. But yeah, I'm kind of rambling about it at this point. Like there's a ridiculous
really
amount of
cool,
information
dude.
In here.
We should do a follow-up interview after I've had a chance to kind of go through it, and then we could talk about it and maybe come up with some takeaways that someone can use right away. But then of course, you know, if you want the whole thing, you gotta go and get it.
Yeah,
you gotta
yeah.
go buy it from Nick. So Nick, dude, this was a great first interview. I would love to do a follow-up with you on this, and maybe you and I, we can continue our conversation offline and talk about some other things as well.
Oh, sure.
But I really appreciate you. I appreciate your perspective. And if you're listening right now, Nick's one of the people who are out there trying to sift through the bullshit. And what I mean by that is this: it takes effort to challenge your own beliefs. It takes effort to believe something, then you come across something that challenges your beliefs, and you're like, no, that's got to be wrong because I believe the opposite. Mm-hmm. It takes effort and a certain level of emotional intelligence, and dare I say health, to say, you know what? I don't like what I'm reading right now because it goes against what I believe and want to believe, quite frankly. But I'm going to set that aside because I have a higher purpose here to help others. And I don't want to be one of those people who are feeding into the bullshit and leading people to these false ideas, false ideologies that ultimately get people into groups and get them together and get them really passionate, but don't get them the results that they're looking for. I mean, so many of the people in the low carb and carnivore and the keto groups, they don't get good results, man. But you can tell they really enjoy talking about ketones and conversing with each other. Story for another time. But the point is this, ladies and gentlemen, is Nick someone out there who's doing that diligence, as am I. And so he's someone that you want to learn from and want to connect with. So Nick, I know you are on Twitter, but I know you have a blog. Where do you want people to connect with you after this interview, just to, you know, reach out, learn more about you, and perhaps look into your nutrient density guide?
Oh, I'd say the most reliable place to find me is probably on Twitter. That's where that's probably the largest point of contact between me and the internet at the moment. So the handle on Twitter is @_Nutrivore, and that's me. And you can tell it's me because it says Nick Hebert. And from there, you can find a link to my blog. And from my blog, you can find a link to the nutrient density cheat sheet. And you can find links to all of the other ways to contact me, including my email address. So the most reliable way to access all of my social media is probably just to go to my Twitter page.
Excellent. And I'm going to have that on the show notes, Nick. And man, really, really glad that you and I connected, and that, you know, what I feel is like we really have to band together and to make sure that people are getting the best information out there. Because I don't want people to fall into this. I have got a client from Twitter. I'm really mincing my Twitter. Every time I think of Twitter, I'm like merging it with another word. But like, I have a client who came from Twitter, and he's just got so many misconceptions about seed oils and other things. And I have to lead with results, but very gently kind of nudge him towards, you know, the fact that these things that he believes are not true and not even that important.
Yeah.
And we don't want that.
Yeah.
We don't want people falling prey to that.
I think like a lot of people lose like 95% for 5%. Like a lot of people are really focused on the 5% optimization before they have even laid down a foundation. Like if you're talking about seed oils and sugar, but you're not lifting weights, like it's just noise.
You can stop there.
It's silly.
Right.
It's silly.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Well, hey, it was a pleasure. Can't wait to have you back on the show. And thanks so much for taking the time out to do this.
No problem, man. My pleasure.
That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Nick. Nick is someone who I can't wait to have back on the show. He's really done his due diligence when it comes to understanding nutrition and diving into the literature, the place where we inform ourselves about what is true, what is not, when it comes to nutrition. So I hope you got a lot out of that conversation. Can't wait to get him back on the show. And I want to say this: nutrition can be complicated, but if you are having struggles trying to get yourself in shape and you don't know what to believe out there, but you know that coaching is the way to get to the next level of health, of fat loss, the next level with your body, the next level with your energy levels. And you've been listening to this podcast and you know I might know a thing or two about how to do that. What I want you to do is I want you to go to legendarylifeprogram.com/apply and apply for a call, a breakthrough call. And on this call, you and I are going to discuss what's working for you, what's not working for you, and where you want to go. And if I can help you get there, I may invite you into one of my coaching programs. But if not, that's cool too. And I want to be really straight about who this is for. If you are an entrepreneur, business owner, or other high performer, and time is money to you, and you don't have time to read 1,000 different blogs, listen to, 700 different podcasts to figure out how to get results. If you want it done for you with an expert who has a proven system and has helped every single person who's come through his program, you're who I want to talk to. So again, that address is legendarylifeprogram.com/apply. All right. Hope you enjoyed today's interview. Have a great week, and I'll speak to you on Friday.